Source is a podcast made by women for women. We talk with a wide variety of experts, ranging from a sex therapist to the CDC and everywhere in between, to bring you the stories you're only going to hear here. Our goal is to entertain and educate, because it's more clear now than ever just how much we as women are doing as parents, as spouses, employees, just as everything. Don't miss out on being in the know. Subscribe to Soul Source wherever you listen to podcasts today. Leave us a review too, because this part's really important. When you leave those reviews, that's how we're able to continue bringing you the content you love each and every week. So buckle up, Soul Source Society, because we're about to get started.
It just breaks the myth, and it breaks this idealized version of, you know, whatever we're seeing all the time, because the more you're exposed to those images, that's what gets into your mind as what's ideal and beautiful and attainable, but it's not attainable.
Hello there, everybody. I'm your host of Soul Source, Raquel Lamel. Thank you for listening today. And let's get real for a second, because I'm going to talk about food. And I know I have a love-hate relationship when it comes to food, especially after having a baby, doing the breastfeeding thing. I mean, I love food. I love trying all different kinds of food. It's a great way to connect with people, but it also kind of sucks, to be honest. I mean, I find myself often, especially now, every morning I get up, I'm checking the scale, I watch those numbers. I just, you know, you gain a pound or two. And I mean, I know I've seen the posts. They tell me to love my body, right? I grew a human and I'm feeding that human. And, you know, it's this amazing thing. But it's still hard, because you see the images, you see the people, you know, back to pre-baby weight after 6 weeks. And that's just me personally. I know a lot of my friends even struggle with food, even not in relation to pregnancy. They just struggle with, you know, eating, especially as the holidays are coming up. And, you know, we're getting ready to enjoy Thanksgiving, Christmas, all the good food that comes with that, but then also watching the scale. And I know a lot of women struggle with that. So my guest today, and someone that I personally think we can all benefit a little bit from, Dr. Christina Castagnini. She's a certified eating disorder specialist. And before you go, oh, I don't have an eating disorder, so this doesn't matter. Let me tell you, a lot of disorders, they can kind of mask themselves in things people call diets. So to help me break this all down, help us all feel a little bit better about food, is Dr. Christina Castagnini. Welcome to Soul Source. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
I'm really excited to have you here. As I mentioned, you know, this is such a good topic, especially right now. It's very timely. So let's ask right off the bat, how did you get started in eating disorder work?
Well, actually, much like you said, I was younger and I was feeling really out of control of my body. I went through puberty and I did not know what was happening. I was getting boobs and hips way before my peers. I'm full-blooded Italian, and nobody really talked to me about, hey, these changes are going to happen, but happened probably a year or two before my friends, and I felt really out of control, self-conscious. There's some other things going on. I had a birth defect when I was younger, and I was feeling really self-conscious about that because I was going to be in my aunt's wedding and thought, oh my gosh, all these eyeballs are going to be on me and see like this thing coming down the aisle, and I just felt so self-conscious. It's already hard enough to be a teenager, right? So, and I was a preteen at that point. And so I thought, well, I got to figure out how to control this a little bit. And so, much like you were just talking about, thought, well, let me just try to control my weight a little bit, right? And back then, you know, I'm older, like all that I had was magazines and radio and like TV. And so back then, Slim Fast was the big thing. And so I thought, well, yeah, I'm just going to go get a can of Slim Fast. What little allowance money I had, ran down to the store and snuck a can into my house. And I thought I was under the radar with my family. But that's how it all started. And it just morphed into something that turned into years of an eating disorder and horrible, horrible years of my life.
And can you talk a little bit about that? What happened that led to the disorder?
So I didn't even realize it. It was just, I kept thinking, gosh, you know, I'm trying so hard. And I was an athlete too. So I was in sports year round. And I thought, gosh, you know, like, I just don't look like my friends. I'm not looking like the people 90210. I'm not looking like all these people on TV in the magazines. And I was reading about all these celebrities really in the magazines. And they always had like a profile of what they were eating or what they weight or how tall they were. And I was comparing myself, like, oh, well, if they can look like that and they can weigh that much, then I can too. And I remember just kind of like getting really in depth with it and thinking, well, what am I doing wrong? If they're eating this much and working out this much, and I am too, and I don't look like that, maybe I better eat less and less and exercise more and more. And I still wasn't looking like that. So I thought, gosh, I better up the ante. And I kept feeling like a failure and something was wrong with me. Like I had some magical body that wasn't working. And it really got me down a horrible path where I was then trying all sorts of things. So restriction wasn't working, over exercise wasn't working. And then I ended up going, gosh, I'm so hungry. Right. So then it was like, I really wanted to eat, but then I felt guilty. So then I found ways to get rid of it, purging, all sorts of ways of purging. So it was just years of me just feeling awful and trying to manipulate my body and food and not really realizing that I just thought I was a horrible failure at dieting. But that was not what was going on.
Oh my gosh. And it's so hard too. And I can only imagine it's gotten harder because you talk about like that time it was celebrities and magazines. It was the same thing for me growing up. And now it's social media and everybody can look perfect, right? But that's not reality.
Right, because now, everybody's on social media. So what you're seeing are actually not just celebrities and movie stars, but and models. You're seeing people you actually know or real life people. But the problem is you don't even know if those are real photos or real pictures because there's so many filtering apps and things too, Photoshop and things like that, that it gives this impression that everybody looks perfect. Everybody has no pores. Everybody's amazing looking, but you, right? So it's the pressure's on.
Oh yeah. So, you started off talking about this a little bit about how you were just obsessing over your weight and it kind of turned into something more. Talk with me about that piece. What does an eating disorder look like, and is it always recognizable? Do people realize it, or they just think they're dieting?
I don't think most people come in even for treatment. I think most people think it's something else. Most people, well, so the path I went through, 'cause to kind of finish your question, how did I end up doing this? I went through recovery, thank goodness, over the years, and I went full recovery. I always wanted to be a psychologist, but I did not want to, I guess, perpetuate that myth that we all bring our own problems into the room with our patients. And so I wanted to steer clear of treating eating disorders, to be honest with you. I wanted to do couples and families and kids, but not eating disorders. But as fate has it, when I started getting patients into my office for intakes, I noticed I was asking questions and really connecting with them. And it was for the first time most people started to really divulge what they were doing with food and how they felt about themselves and their bodies. And well, years later, figured out that I could really relate to them and they didn't really have to say a whole lot and I just got it. So I figured I never had that therapist in my recovery that had walked the walk and been through recovery and was able to look me in the eye and say, hey, you know what? I get it and you can recover. The only myth I had was you're never going to recover fully. You're always going to kind of have this. And I really want to instill that hope in people when they come in that stick this out. It's going to be hard. I get it. But you can fully recover. So that's why I ended up doing this and sort of becoming a certified eating disorder specialist.
Well, and there is something, to that point of having walked the walk, right? Like you can relate on a level that somebody who's just a specialist maybe can't.
Right. And I think there is some power in that because the thoughts that people have when they have an eating disorder and the behaviors they engage in, they're so hidden and they're not anything someone who doesn't have one would ever think about. So for instance, when I work with people who don't have an eating disorder, their relationship with food is so different. So it's almost like the question of, well, how do you know you have one? It's almost like, well, if you don't have one, you definitely know. Food is more, I mean, the purpose of food is fuel and nutrition. Right. I mean, we don't plug in like a cell phone, right? What keeps us alive is food. And so that's our whole fuel source. If you think about, like, you were talking about having a baby, right? Like, when your baby's hungry, your baby cries.
Yes, he does.
Like, feed me, mom, right? So in tune with like what the body needs to stay alive. And you're the care provider and it's like, mom, feed me. And when your son is no longer hungry, he's not screaming anymore. He's like done, right? He doesn't continue going, hey, feed me like all day long. there's no emotional connection to the food. It's just survival at that point. And we're all born like that. But somewhere along the way, food becomes something different. It's not just fuel and nutrition anymore. It's where does it become an emotional thing, or where does it become something else? And that's the difference. So for people who do not have disorder eating or eating disorder, it starts to take on a whole different role where people say, I don't even know when I'm hungry anymore. I don't know when I'm full. I don't know what no longer hungry feels like. It takes on a whole different level where it just consumes their entire life and entire being. So I can speak more to that, but there's really just a whole different thought pattern around food. It's more like, you know, if I eat this, I feel guilty. The good food, bad food lists that are just, I mean, controlling their world. And so if they eat something on the good food list, whatever that is, everybody has their own, I feel good. It's now a moral judgment on themselves. If I eat something on the quote unquote bad food list, I'm bad. I feel bad. And there's almost like a penance to pay. Like, oh, I ate this. Now I feel guilty. Now I feel bad. I'm bad. I've got to do something to compensate for this. Or like they just berate themselves in their mind all day long. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. What did I do? And I hear people say this all the time. Like, oh gosh, I must have gained 5 pounds. I just ate that donut. Or, you know, and I don't like to talk weight. So sorry if that triggers anybody, me saying that. But that's the kind of stuff that goes on in the mind. Or gosh, I feel fat. And I say, well, fat's not a feeling. What's really happening here? And so this is this incessant thing that goes on and on. Whereas most people, well, people who don't have disordered eating or eating disorders, they can eat a donut and then they eat it and move on. That's the end of it, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, okay. When do you know if you're a person and you know, you're maybe borderline, having a disorder, but you think you're on a diet, because if you're dieting, you're watching what you're eating, right? So you're like, you would be, if I ate a donut and you're on a diet, you're like, oh shoot, I shouldn't have done that. You know, now I'm going to eat salads the rest of the day. Like that's pretty common reaction if someone's dieting or they're trying to stick within a 1200 calorie diet, you know, or things like that. So how do you know when it's becoming something more? What is the difference?
Well, so what you just said, right? Like if, let's say you're following a diet, right? And you're just like, oh shoot, like I didn't follow it today. Right, you're just like, all right, maybe I'll throw it over tomorrow. It was called like the last supper, right? When you take on a diet, you're like, okay, I'm gonna eat everything today, and then Monday I'll start.
Yeah, oh yeah,
it's kind of like that, or like, okay, I'll get back on track tomorrow. But it's not this, oh my gosh, beating yourself up. Like, I'm so bad. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I just did that. Now I gotta go to the gym and work out for 2 hours, or it, like, okay, I can't go. You know, sleep. I can't sleep all night. I got to get up super early tomorrow to make sure I get to the gym. Or it's just, it takes over the mind. So I'll ask people, how much of your day is spent thinking about food or your body or your weight or exercise? And all, it's like, they'll say like, oh my gosh, all day long, like all the time. I don't think about anything else. And it's just, okay. That's it. It's like all the time. And they will alter their behaviors and make decisions based on making sure that they can, you know, get the right foods or prepare their foods or make sure they fit in exercise. They have like rituals with their food and with their eating disorder behaviors. So say somebody says, I have to absolutely work out 60 minutes a day or an hour, you know, 90 minutes. And it has to be a certain thing. Like maybe it's 60 minutes cardio and 30 minutes of, you know, weights. And if they don't hit those exact numbers, then they don't consider that an actual workout. It's not a real workout, quote unquote, real workout.
Okay.
They will, what I call, negotiate with the eating disorder in their mind. Like, okay, I didn't quite hit it today. And they feel guilty. They feel kind of off. Their emotional state for the day is really off. And they may, you know, negotiate with their eating disorder. Like, okay, now I can only eat, you know, quote unquote, in their mind, their whatever their list of good foods are for the day. Or they will eat less the rest of the day or deprive themselves of what they really want to eat.
So it becomes like all consuming, basically.
Right.
Okay.
Do things like skip work or class, or like I said, say no to parties or people invite them out to eat dinner. No, because they have to fit in that 90 minutes over and beyond everything else.
Okay. Okay. So let's talk about, you know, girls and teens specifically, because I feel like that is, like you said, you know, your puberty time is a really big trigger point for a lot of women and girls. Is that a common time for eating disorders to strike, or are they really common among that age group?
Well, it's interesting. I think that's the myth, is that that's the only age group that has it. And it's across the board, I'll be honest with you. I think eating disorders are prevalent across all ages, across all genders, cultures, ethnicities. They don't discriminate, right? So I think that's the first thing to get out there is people think, oh, because I'm male, I can't have an eating disorder. Or because I'm a 35-year-old female, I can't have an eating disorder. Or it's only teenage, Caucasian girls in middle class, socioeconomic status. It's like, no, that's not it. It's all over the place, across the board. Because what it's really about is control. Somebody's really feeling out of control with something, and food is one way to try to control, whether it's emotions or there's something else. It's not really, it's about the food, but it's not about the food.
Okay. Is there an age where this typically starts? Do you see something more common than others?
Again, it's interesting. The vast majority of the population I'm working with right now are actually older. They're like 50 and older.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. That's like you said, that's not what I would personally expect. So, wow.
Right. And I think there's something to that. So talked a little bit about hormonal changes in the body too for females, whether it's puberty or menopause, and the body shifts during both of those times. And so if you think about that feeling out of control and like, oh my gosh, I can't control my body, what's going on? Or maybe even feeling there's a lot of developmental things going on maybe at that age too, if whether it's the kids are getting older, if somebody has a family and empty nest syndrome or career changes or perhaps a divorce, something might trigger that as well. So there might be contributing factors that go along with that as well.
Okay, that's a good point. That's a super good point, actually. So, is there, everybody goes through that. Everybody goes through puberty and everybody goes through menopause. If you're a woman, it's going to happen. So, is there a reason that you think women in particular end up with this obsession with weight and worry about this?
Well, I will answer that, but I will say, men also have eating disorders, and I
Right.
think they're not talking about it enough. We're trying, I think it's becoming more prevalent, and men are coming out more talking about it. But because the myth has always been it's a female illness or women have eating disorders, that's mostly what people think is only women have eating disorders. But if you look at society and media and we live in a culture where thinness is valued. Unfortunately, we call it toxic diet culture. You're more valued if you're thinner, and you're considered healthy if you're thinner. And that's all crap, to be honest with you, right? Why is value placed on thinness, and why are you considered healthy if you're thinner? And so that's perpetuated over and over and over again by the diet and beauty industry. They're a $76 billion industry, right? So they're perpetuating this myth out there because it benefits them. Why are they a $76 billion industry? Because of that. They put these images out there, right? These beautiful models and this and that, and they portray them to be so happy and living these amazing lives. And so the thought is, wow, these amazingly thin, whatever, unrealistic, unidealized images of these people, that's how you're going to be happy. That's how you're going to have this amazing life, right? This is the image in everyone's mind. And so if you don't have that, then, well, I can't be happy, right? That's how I hear this all the time. I can only be happy if I lose weight or if I look like that. And so it's like, well, if I'm not, then, I've got to do whatever I can to get there. And so that's the thought. It's like, okay, who doesn't think that sometimes as a woman?
Oh, yeah.
Images, right? But then I ask,
Yep.
so how many supermodels do you see walking around?
Yeah, and then for example, like talking about this with you, like the name that comes to mind, and I think of like she was the supermodel and she got out of that realm. Tyra Banks is the first person, right? And it's like she's done. I remember the famous swimsuit poses where she was like posing with the swimsuit, and she was like, "You can look fat in this one, and you can look skinny in this one. It's all in how you stand and how you pose." And she talks about like the food restrictions and stuff she had as a supermodel. It's crazy the difference, you know?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad when people come out and talk about all of that because it just breaks the myth and it breaks this idealized version of whatever we're seeing all the time, because the more you're exposed to those images, that's what gets into your mind as what's ideal and beautiful and attainable, but it's not attainable because you're seeing it all the time over and over and over again. And, I didn't grow up with the internet, thank goodness. Like, it was bad enough for me with the magazines and I can't imagine now, like my daughter's 12, almost 13, and like I can't imagine how many images she is exposed to day after day after day. I try to limit the social media and we try to talk about it, but it's incessant, right? It's all the time. And if you're seeing that all the time, that's what gets into our minds as what we need to strive for or what people need to look like. And so it's a lot of education about that's not realistic, that's not ideal. And we need to start putting other images in there of all sorts of bodies, a diverse, diverse, pictures of all sorts of body types and images, because that's what reality is. We don't have just one body type out there that everybody has. We just don't.
Right. So to that point, you and I had had an interesting conversation before we got on this call today, and you had talked about the past year and a half with COVID and the impact it's had on people in general, and what you've seen. Talk with me a little bit about that.
Well, right. So we were isolated. We were home. And so people were on social media and exposed to a lot more advertisements and images of fake people, if you were, than we were real people. We didn't interact with people in real life as much as we were interacting with people on social media or seeing these images that were filtered to us. And so whether it was actual celebrities or movie stars or models or people we knew or, quote unquote, real people we saw, they were images. And so hours and hours and hours of that, right? And people feeling very out of control with their life. They didn't know what was going on. So there was an increase in depression and anxiety, right? And so when people are feeling that way, a lot of people felt like, I need to control something. I need to do something. And like I said before, with eating disorders, oftentimes that can be an impetus for it is like, okay, I can control my food. Hey, the pantry's right here. I can control my food. And food became a comfort for lots of people as well during this time. It was very scary. And so people's relationship with food and their bodies, there's a lot, an increase in eating disorders definitely during COVID.
Well, and two, I know a lot of gyms, like you talk about a lot of people using that as a way to cope. A lot of them are closed down and they try to do the virtual thing, but it's not the same. So I'm sure that was hard.
Well, what I initially saw were the patients I had in my practice who were using the gym as their purging technique, say, they really got an increase in anxiety because that was, like I said, that was their ritual. They had to fit in X number of minutes, or they had to fit that class, whatever class they had in every day. And so when that was gone, and then they were stuck in the house, like some of them by themselves, that was really devastating. And there was a huge spike in like their depressive symptoms and an increase in like their restriction, like, okay, if I can't go exercise, I'm going to compensate to their eating disorder. Mine was like, okay, their eating disorder told them I can't do that, so I have to really restrict now. I have to go do other things, right, to compensate for that. And the thing that's very scary is eating disorders are the number one deadliest mental illness of all mental illnesses. And so when we look at that, they are comorbid with oftentimes with depression and anxiety. And so when you combine an eating disorder with depression, there's a propensity sometimes for people to have suicidal ideation. We really need to be aware of that and get that information out there that people can be at risk for suicide, not just the medical or physical complications of having an eating disorder.
So this question, then the natural follow-up for me is how do you know? How can someone, like if you've got a friend or a family member, how would you know if someone is struggling so that you could maybe intervene?
Right, and it is hard because I'll be honest with you, most people hide. They hide how they're feeling. They're very ashamed of what they're doing or what they're thinking. And to the surface, it doesn't oftentimes look like they have one. And I often hear even medical doctors say, like, they don't look like they have an eating disorder. And most people, you know, I think that's a big myth. First of all, the myth is you can look at somebody and know if they have an eating disorder. Well, first, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely cannot look at anybody and know. So if you just think, oh, no, they don't look like they have one. Okay. Or oftentimes I hear, well, they're just being healthy. But they'll say that too. They will oftentimes have the identity of like the healthy person, one who eats really healthy or exercises a lot and gets this praise, or everyone will tell them, gosh, I wish I had your motivation, or I wish I could eat like you. Or, you know, people might even go to them and say, like, give me some diet tips, or can you help motivate me, or tell me what you're doing. And so people will oftentimes not get it.
Mm-hmm.
And they will not want to lose that identity oftentimes either. And so it's very tricky. So to the outside world, it may not be something that's seen at all.
That's scary because it could almost be like feeding into it, right? You're praising them for, so that cannot be good. That's got to have the opposite effect, I would assume.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it is, you know, I work with people right now, I'm just thinking about that, have that identity. They're so afraid of, if I go into recovery, I'm no longer going to have that identity as the quote unquote healthy person or the one at the gym who's got all the attention because I'm working out all the time. Or what am I going to do? Like, who am I going to be if I don't have this? It's scary.
Mm-hmm. So you have the psychology background, and then you also are working with the eating disorder side of things. So can you talk with me about the mind? Because this is a battle of the mind. And what happens to the mind if somebody is being so restrictive with their food?
Right. And so that's a whole nother thing. So figuring out how much someone's restricting and for how long, because the brain can atrophy to the point where I can't do therapy with them. I do outpatient, which is the lowest level of care. There's different levels of care. And sometimes I will need to do an assessment and figure out where they're at in terms of their eating disorder symptoms. And if they've been restricting and they're medically compromised, we'll have to put them in a higher level of care, where sometimes it's, you know, in an inpatient hospital where they need to be even on a feeding tube sometimes just to get their body restored to a place of being medically stable. Because I can't do any kind of outpatient treatment if they can't actually think and engage in therapy, because their brain is just not capable of doing that. So each and every person's different. So, it's really hard to even give you generalities, because each person is so different. And oftentimes when they come in, they're even lying to me because they're so ashamed to even vocalize it to themselves. There's a lot of secrecy with eating disorders. And that's one thing I really want to put out there, is you're only sick as your secrets. And people really start to get better once they just open up and share what they're really doing and what they're really thinking, which is probably the hardest thing in the world to do.
I like that line, you're only as sick as your secrets. That's a really good point, and I think it sums up what you're talking about so well.
Well, and it's true, because I remember lying to my therapist too for years. I would say, like, if I had just been honest, you know, earlier, I probably would have gotten better so much sooner. But it's so scary, because the stuff you're doing, you think, oh my gosh, like, I'm going to get so judged, or someone's going to look at me and be like, ew, or like, you what? Because your self-esteem is so low, and you always feel so bad about yourself, and you're not good enough. And the last thing you want to do is like put it out there and have somebody be like, you're confirming that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard.
What could be, I know we talked about this a little bit too, but there are trigger words. What could some of those be, and how do you avoid using those?
Oh yeah. And it's, you know, and I know, because people in someone's life, they're usually loving and caring and don't even know they're saying things, and they're just trying to be loving. But oftentimes, like, someone who's restricting, say, if somebody says, wow, you look really healthy. Oh, that's like a horrible thing to hear. It's like all someone hears when they hear that is, I've gained weight, or I look quote unquote fat. And so that can send someone into a tailspin of restriction, more restriction. That's like a horrible word here. Or If somebody says, well, you know, I'm just concerned about your health. No, maybe you should watch what you're eating. That's a horrible thing to say to somebody because you don't really know what they're doing behind closed doors. Like I said, you can't look at somebody and know if they have an eating disorder. And, you know, there's something called atypical anorexia where somebody is actually engaging in all the behaviors of anorexia. They're really restrictive, but they're in a much larger body than someone would expect. And so to say that to somebody, then again, they're going to end up restricting even more and get more sick. So that's, you know, something I know people mean well when they say like, I'm just worried about your health, but ouch, right? Or making comments about people's, what they have on their plate, like, wow, that's a lot. Or, wow, you eat so much. Or, you know, maybe you should cut down. Or do you really need seconds? Or just, or you eat like a bird.
Yep. I was going to go with that one. Yep.
Meals are what they're choosing to eat. It's really hard. They don't want the attention on them at all with what they're eating.
And so many of those things, even those phrases you just said, they're phrases that I know I have personally heard, and I know family members of mine have heard themselves too. And so it is something that I think is so common and people don't even realize, you know, and if you don't know, if you don't know if somebody is struggling with something or not, you could actually be doing more harm. So what do you suggest people do then to avoid these phrases and not say something, you know, like, for example, what's coming to mind is like, I could see like a mother, right? A mother is going to comment if she sees something with her kid, right? You know, you should be eating more, you're not eating enough, or whatever. So how do you avoid those trigger phrases but still show you care?
So I always ask, I'm a mom too, right? It's like, how much of that's our own anxiety?
Yep.
Feeling like we are not feeding our kids well enough or doing enough, or like, what is the real concern there, right? What's going on? Is it more about us, or is it really what's happening? Are we afraid people are going to judge us for like being a bad parent or like not feeding our kids, right? Like what's happening there? Mm-hmm. Are we internalized diet culture ourselves or bought into like this food is bad or that food's good? Like what's happening? So that's kind of the first step, is sit back and say like, what's going on there? And is this comment, what's this comment really, what's the goal of it?
Okay. So is the best thing, maybe the best approach, say nothing?
Well, I think that's the thing, is the fear is if I say nothing, what are you afraid is going to happen?
I mean, if you're the one making the comment, I don't know. Maybe you're hoping that they're, you know, going to, you know, eat more if you don't think they're eating enough, you know, maybe, you know, if that's where it's coming from. If it's coming from a place of caring, you're obviously hoping for something with the comment you're making, and you're not meaning any harm by it.
Right. Because, you know, if say you're a parent and you're just noticing some different behavior with food, like you're noticing your child hiding food and eating more or something like that, rather than making the focus on the actual food or the body, I've noticed you're gaining weight, or, you know, I think you need to go to the gym and like, you know, lose some weight, or anything that's like focused on the body and the actual behavior, maybe take it off of that and recognize again, it's not really about the food, but say, hey, you know what, check in. Hey, how you doing? Notice maybe, you know, you haven't been talking as much, or things going all right. Maybe check in and just see how they're actually doing first, and see if there's something else going on. If you're noticing a change, or you're really worried about anything else.
Okay.
Because again, it's not about the food. Or if you're noticing when someone's restricting or not, maybe not eating breakfast or making excuses not to eat dinner, or, you know, noticing a big shift in their weight in a different way. And you're concerned, just again, checking in and just being like, hey, how you doing? And if they're just closed-lipped and not talking, maybe you can even say like, you know, it's really hard to be a kid these days. Like, if there's anything you don't want to talk to me about, do you ever want to see a counselor? Like, maybe something like that. Because if there's like a drastic shift and change in the way your kids are eating or looking, there's probably something going on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that helps. That's what I was kind of hoping for, was a little bit of a guidance. Cause I know that can be a tricky spot to be in, and how do you approach those conversations? So that is a lot of help. You know, society as a general, a lot of what we're talking about today is a societal problem. So in your opinion, how do we as a society start to work toward change to maybe stop having, you know, eating disorders be such a problem in society?
Well, I think we need to talk about it more. So I'm glad you're having this podcast. And I think, you know, I'm seeing it more and more. I think there is more awareness. I think there are more discussions about the filtering apps, about Photoshop photos, about, you know, even supermodels coming out and talking about like what they did, you know, with their food and their body that was not okay. And you know, I think I was talking to you before this about like, I was watching the Late Late Show and like Rihanna was on and like, she has this fashion show sort of thing going on with her clothesline and she's got models with different bodies and diversity and like all shapes and sizes. And I was like really thrilled about that. And like Victoria's Secret canceled their Angel show, which I'm like, yay, finally. Because, you know, little girls watch that, even women watch that. And it's like, who looks like that? Nobody. So just to have more exposure to real bodies and what real people look like is, I think, very key. But also having the discussion with your kids, you know, and if you see something that is in social media or on a TV show or in a movie that sounds toxic, just having the conversations so they can critically think about things and have a critical mind when they're watching things or seeing things.
Okay. My last question, well, second to last question for you, is about, you know, we're heading into the holidays. So any advice from you on just, you know, what people should know as we're approaching? Food is such a big part of holiday season. So what would you want people to know?
Well, you know, I think it's always such a trigger, right? Because I think we forget food is part of our, like, social connections with people, right? When we go out, it's to eat, or there's those special foods that like are connected to tradition and people and times, right? So you might get grandma's special cookies at Christmas that you never get, and like, why can't we enjoy that? Like, what are we doing, you know? Or Thanksgiving, it's a whole day of eating, like, enjoy. Why are we so afraid, instead of like fearing it and like going, oh my gosh, like I'm so scared of this day, and like, you know, after this, I gotta like go, whatever, make up for it. Just saying, like, why can't you enjoy the food? Mm-hmm. Right? Embrace it and just be connected to the food and taste it and enjoy it and enjoy it. Or, you know, here's the other thing. Sometimes the holidays aren't that great for people. Sometimes acknowledging too that the holidays are hard. Mm-hmm. It's not always joyous and festive and wonderful for people. And for people that are like not looking forward to the holidays, acknowledge that too. Like, are you coping with food in a different way? Maybe it's, yep, a companion, maybe it's a comfort. And you know, so I think oftentimes we acknowledge that too, like how difficult it is to see all the Hallmark like commercials or all of the people, you know, going out Christmas shopping or holiday shopping, and like maybe you're just, you don't have anybody to shop for, you're feeling very lonely, and the holidays are tough.
In general, yes, they are. Absolutely, in more ways than one.
Yeah, and so I think when it comes to food too, if you're having any struggles with food and you're using food for comfort and you're stressed, you know, it can bring some financial issues. From, you know, holidays can be expensive, or missing loved ones, especially. I don't know if people are still kind of hesitant to travel right now. And last year was really hard for people. That's hard too, right? Mm-hmm. So the holidays can bring up lots of things, and you know, as an eating disorder specialist, I always kind of brace myself for January.
It's like a wave.
You know, it's like all the diet, like new year, new you, weight loss, this weight loss. They just come bombarding you, knowing that most people are feeling a little down or self-conscious about any quote unquote holiday weight gain they had, because who puts that out there, right? The diet and beauty industry perpetuates this myth of like, oh my gosh, like you should feel like so horrible because you gained holiday weight and holiday pounds. It's out there, and it's like, why is it out there?
Yeah.
But then it's like, oh, you feel bad. Here it is. You feel bad about yourself. You're feeling self-conscious. You're feeling low. Here's the solution. Come buy our product. Come join our program. Come join the gym. Come do this, right? Who's making all the money off of you feeling bad about yourself?
The industry. Yep.
Mm-hmm. It's notoriously known. Like, most people don't stick to those programs or stick to their you know, gym memberships or whatever, it passed a certain amount of time after that, they just, they grab you, right? Because you're primed for that. So just kind of think about that a little bit. Like, if you're going to eat it, enjoy it.
I was going to say, what would be your last piece of advice? Just eat the damn food, enjoy it.
But if you are struggling with, you know, your body image or your food, or feel like you can't be happy unless you look a certain way or weigh a certain size, or you're just going from diet to diet to diet and feeling like you are the failure because you just can't stick on it. You don't have enough willpower. You just need to do it right, or any of those kinds of things. It is something to think about. Like, maybe it's not just a diet. Maybe you're not, first of all, you're not failing. It's not you that's the failure, but it might be worth just going to talk to somebody and seeing if it's beyond a diet. Maybe it's something else.
And to that point, if, you know, you're one of these people they can talk to, so how do people get a hold of you to be able to connect and find out if there is something more going on?
Sure. Well, I have a podcast as well. It's Behind the Bite. And I'm on Instagram at Behind the Bite, and my website has all the links to everything. It's behindthebitepodcast.com.
That's a great place to start, right? To learn just about in general, like different things that are going on, so people can kind of decide if maybe there is something more. Tell me a little bit about your podcast.
Sure. Well, I wanted to come at it. So I was working at a hospital for 15 years, and I was like, you know what? I'm behind the same four walls. I'm not really having much of an impact, and I'm getting older, and I want to kind of do something different with my career. My kids are older now. So I really wanted to come at it from the personal perspective and the professional perspective, because I have both now. Have people on. I talked about my own stuff in the beginning just so people know, like, hey, I'm not just this professional who's going to like talk about all the, you know, research and this and that. But so I have real people on there who are struggling or who have struggled and have recovered. And I have professional people on there who are experts and talk about, you know, eating disorders from an expert perspective. So it's a little mix of a bag. And I came at it from that thinking, what would I have wanted when I was going through this? What could have helped me? Because I think if they're in the stories of people who are thinking it, living it, have been through it, that helps you feel like you're less alone. Or like if you hear it, go, wow, okay, I think that too, or I do that too. Okay, maybe it's not me. Maybe I can get help for this. Because when you realize it's an illness, it's not a choice, it really helps.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are going to have links to Behind the Bite here in the show notes of Soul Source so people can check it out and they can learn more and they can get in touch with you. Doctor, we appreciate you being here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. And if you want to hear more Soul Source, just subscribe to our show. We're available wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can watch us too. We're on YouTube. Just look for Soul Source. Soul Source is brought to you by Red Shoes, Inc., a leading agency specializing in crisis and strategic communications, media relations, social media, and so much more. To learn more about Soul Source and Red Shoes, visit us at redshoesinc.com.